Pittsburgh Section, National Council of Jewish Women, Oral History Project 2. Interviewing Mr. Aaron on December 24th, 1975, for the second hour. Interviewers, Eleanor Langer and Marcia Frommerman. Mr. Aaron, when last we were together, you were beginning to mention to us about the Rode of Sholem and the change to the unassigned pew system. Could you elaborate on how that change came about for us?
When Dr. Goldenson came to Pittsburgh in 1918, he was troubled by the assigned pew system, which provided fixed seats and tended to divide the congregation on the basis of those who could afford the luxury of pews and those who were merely seat holders. In the year 1920, he asked the congregation to adopt the unassigned pew system. And as of April 1st, 1920, that change was put into effect on a temporary basis. At that time, the congregation had a membership of 549 members and 240 seat holders. As a result of the change to the unassigned pew system, a great many new members were added to the congregation, and in the course of 2 years, the membership increased to a total of 1,128 members, so that there was a very dramatic growth in membership, and with very helpful results in the democratic character of the congregation. The change was approved as a final and permanent change in the year 1922 and has been the basis of congregational life ever since. The change meant that the congregation theoretically was open to all who cared to join at whatever contribution the individual might be able to bring to the congregation. After a few years, it became apparent that an effort needed to be made to encourage larger contributions from those who were able to make such contributions so as to carry the large number who could not. And that, of course, has been a continuing problem with the unassigned pew system, that it has been necessary constantly to urge the support of the congregation on a more generous basis by those who are able to do so.
If we consider the unassigned pew system as one of the highlights of Rabbi Goldenson's era, are there any others that you can mention for us that would mark or highlight the time that Rabbi Goldenson served Rode of Sholem congregation?
I don't recall whether in the last session we talked about the change to the Union Prayer Book. I think we did. And that, didn't I? At any rate, shortly after Dr. Goldenson came to Pittsburgh, he asked the congregation to change and adopt the Union Prayer Book for Sabbath and Holy Day services. Previously, we had used the Einhorn Prayer Book. The Einhorn Prayer Book was a predecessor of the Union Prayer Book and had been translated into English by Dr. Emil G. Hirsch of Chicago. It was a remarkable prayer book, but tended somewhat to reflect the background of German sentence structure and the Union Prayer Book was in use by most of the Reformed congregations in the country, and Dr. Gildenson asked the congregation to adopt the Union Prayer Book. The congregation voted to adopt it, and then after a few years, the Union Prayer Book was also used as instead of the Sunday Prayer Book, which Dr. J. Leonard Levy had written.
So that wasn't, the J. Leonard Levy Prayer Book was in use until that time?
J. Leonard Levy Prayer Book was in use during Dr. Levy's lifetime and during the early years of Dr. Goldenson's ministry here. At first, the change was made only to the Sabbath, the Holy Day Union Prayer Book, and eventually the weekday service in the Union Prayer Book was used instead of the Levy Prayer Book.
Before we leave, discussion of Rabbi Goldenson, is there anything else that comes to mind that stands out as something he did or something he brought to the congregation?
Well, there were many things he brought to the congregation, especially remarkable gift of mind and of speech, and deep dedication to liberal and reform Judaism. Dr. Goldenson was most active in the exchange of pulpits with other ministers and rabbis. He spoke widely during his ministry at the temple. Radio came into use, and his Sunday sermons were broadcast, and through the broadcast he succeeded in reaching a very wide audience. Dr. Goldenson also was exceedingly active in support of social justice and the application of the ethical ideals of Judaism to the everyday problems of life. Particularly memorable was a sermon that he delivered on a coal strike that was then creating problems in the Pittsburgh area, and delivered a very memorable Sunday sermon on that subject. He was welcomed everywhere in the liberal churches, spoke to many of them, and when it came time for him to leave Pittsburgh to go to New York, the Protestant ministers of Pittsburgh joined in a farewell civic service at Trinity Cathedral, the Protestant cathedral in Pittsburgh, and there Bishop Mann hailed him as a prophet of righteousness to Jew and Christian alike, and said that he was, like St. Paul, a Hebrew of the Hebrews, and had given all of them many good things to think about. It was a very great and a very wonderful tribute, and Dr. Goldenson responded in the pulpit of Trinity Church on December 31st, 1933, the same day on which he had preached his farewell sermon at Temple.
Were these activities...
In addition, let me, if I may, let me tell you this. At Dr. Goldenson's 50th birthday, a number of the clergymen had come to greet him at a reception in Temple and to speak in his honor. One of them was his good friend, Dr. Petty, the Baptist minister, who spoke of the fact that when he himself had been in a hospital, that Dr. Goldensmith had come to cheer him on and to bless him. And he said if he lived to be a very old man, he would never forget that experience. Dr. Petty did not live to be an old man. He died a year or two later. And the minister who gave the eulogy at his funeral in the First Baptist Church was Dr. Samuel H. Goldens. Those are two illustrations of his message to the clergy. Another one that might be of interest is the experience that he had for a number of years in going to Calvary Episcopal Church on Shady Avenue and preaching at the invitation of his friend Dr. Van Etten, preaching a Holy Day sermon, usually around the time of Sukkot, but he was invited to give at Calvary one of the sermons that he had given at Temple at the High Holy Days, as though he were preaching to his own congregation. And that, again, was a very remarkable and very heartfelt experience. And not only did he go to the pulpits of these churches, but the ministers of these churches came to Temple on occasion, occupied the pulpit, or spoke to Temple organizations. And the relationship was a very happy one, and very gratifying. In doing that, he carried on the sort of work that Dr. Levy had started years before, but it was notable and most significant during Dr. Moses' rabbinate here.
Did the Road of Shalom congregants respond favorably to the ministers of other religions that came to share the pulpit and to speak at their various meetings?
I am sure that the members of the congregation appreciated the friendly spirit and the mutual tolerance and respect which was shown to Dr. Goldensmith and which they were able to show in return.
Now, as Rabbi Goldensmith was reaching out to the larger community, did this leave enough time for him to take care of the activities for the congregants at Road of Shalom?
Dr. Levy had carried on a one-man ministry at the Temple. He had been the rabbi and had served the congregation without any assistant rabbi. A few years after Dr. Goldensmith came to Pittsburgh in 1921, the congregation provided him with an assistant rabbi, and he had an assistant rabbi during all the rest of his years in Pittsburgh. But Dr. Goldensmith did not delegate to the assistant rabbi the work in the congregation, so that he could carry on work outside. On the contrary, he conducted a very definite personal ministry in the congregation and made it his responsibility to know the members of his congregation, to be with them when they needed him in times of joy and in times of sorrow. He was on the friendliest terms with the members of his congregation, and to this day, those who remember him speak most warmly of what Dr. Goldensmith meant to them. In that respect, again, he carried on as Dr. Levy had before. A definite public ministry and also a ministry of personal service.
Can you briefly highlight for us some of the strong indications of Rabbi Levy's rabbinate during his years with us, some things that were outstanding.
Well, in the first place, under Dr. Levy's rabbinate, the congregation had grown from a small congregation in the 8th Street Temple downtown. A congregation that at that time had something like 132 members at the time that Dr. Levy came to Pittsburgh. And in the very month that he came, 105 new members were added. Before the end of that year, the membership had more than doubled. And by 1908, the year after the move to Fifth Avenue, there were 363 members, pew owners and pew renters. And then, as we said, by 1920, when Dr. Goldison came to Pittsburgh, the congregation had grown to 549 members and 240 seat holders. So that there'd been a very steady growth in the congregation under Dr. Levy. And again, Dr. Levy and his ministry had been able to carry the message of Judaism far and wide, not only in the community, but in his travels over the country, in his travels on the Chautauqua circuit in the summertime, where he spoke in tents. And he had reached an enormous number of people in the days before radio, when it was a question of reaching them with the human voice without any assistance. Also, Dr. Levy, during his ministry, had printed his Sunday sermons, so that the Sunday sermon of this week would be printed and in the pews the following week for distribution, and also would be distributed by mail to those who were interested, so that he made a very great effort to spread the message of Judaism far beyond the confines of the congregation.
Could you tell us what relationship that Rabbi Levy had with the children of the religious school?
Dr. Levy taught the confirmation class. He acted as superintendent of the religious school. He was always conducted the assemblies at each week's session. In those days, the school met on Sunday afternoon. Dr. Levy had the Sunday service in the congregation in the morning. Sunday afternoon, the school met, and he was there to conduct the assembly, to lead the children in the singing and in the conduct of their worship services. He was very central to the religious life of all the growing generation. And he taught the confirmation class, taught them at a weekday session, and also on Saturday mornings. And during Dr. Levy's lifetime, the session of the school was divided into two sections, into a Saturday section and a Sunday section. And in that way, the classes that attended the Saturday sessions were able to go to the Saturday morning service in the temple and to hear Dr. Levy preach. And that was a rare privilege and experience for all of us.
In speaking of the sermons of these rabbis, we are aware that you had a hand in editing Dr. Goldenson's sermons. And we wonder how you decided which ones to include in the publication.
I'm afraid that Dr. Goldenson had made that too easy for us. Dr. Levy printed his sermons weekly and regularly. Dr. Goldenson was never satisfied with the transcript that came from the stenographer who recorded the sermons. That was before the days of these tape recorders. And he felt that he really had to do the sermon over again to put it in the literary form in which he wanted to. Consequently, he had the feeling that few of his sermons were worth the effort of doing them twice and then of printing them. Consequently, he had printed relatively few of his sermons. And unfortunately, in preparing the volume of sermons, we did not have the very large number from which to select that we did when the book of Dr. Levy's ministry and his sermons was published. So that, to some extent, Dr. Goldenson had made a pre-selection for us by giving us a smaller number from which to choose.
Did you also have a hand in the book that came out on Dr. Levy's sermons?
I worked with Dr. Friel trying to help in organizing some of that material. He did the major work, but I did work with him, yes.
And were there some guidelines you used to help you choose which of Dr. Levy's to include?
Well, Dr. Friel was kind enough to ask me what I would suggest in the way of sermons to be included. He did not include a large number of sermons in that book. I think there are only seven or eight of them, perhaps, that were published in full. For the others, he had made selections of certain themes or certain passages that he thought could help in a summary of Dr. Levy's views. And he had selected a few of the sermons that he wanted to include, and he gave me the opportunity of suggesting a few others.
And were you happy with the finished product?
Yes, I was very happy with the finished product, although it seemed not wholly fair to limit the large number of Dr. Levy's sermons to the publication of a few. But that was a question of the limited size of the book. Dr. Friel is most helpful, and I wouldn't want anything that I am saying to reflect in any way on his very ready willingness and eagerness to pay tribute to his predecessor.
I wonder if now we could go back to some other material that we found we do not have complete information on. The first question that we have is that you had mentioned that Marcus Aaron was on the board of the temple for 40 years and president for 20 of those years. And I wonder if you could tell us what were some of the...
No, I don't think I said that. At least if I did, I said it incorrectly. He was on the board of the temple for 53 years, 1901 until his death in 1954. He was president of the vice president of the congregation for 20 years, from 1910 to 1930, when Judge Cohen died. And then he was president for 11 years, and when he retired as president of the congregation, he was made honorary president of the congregation for life.
All right, let's talk about those 11 years when he was president of the congregation. I wonder if you could point out for us some of the highlights that you remember during those years?
I'm afraid you didn't give me a chance to prepare an answer to that question, and I don't know whether I can give the answer. Those were the central years of Dr. Freehoff's ministry in Pittsburgh. Dr. Freehoff had come here in 1934. Father was president at the time that Dr. Freehoff came. And in fact, he had a great deal to do with urging Dr. Freehoff to come to Pittsburgh. And Father became president while Dr. Goldenson was still with us. He was unsuccessful, unfortunately, in persuading, in his attempts to persuade Dr. Goldenson to remain in Pittsburgh and not to go to New York. But Dr. Goldenson was determined to go to New York. The congregation turned to Dr. Freehoff, who had been our Holy Day preacher in the early 20s at the additional services for the Holy Days. And Dr. Freehoff came here in 1934. So that Father was president during the last years of Dr. Goldenson's ministry and during the first years of Dr. Freehoff's ministry in Pittsburgh.
So therefore, his influence in bringing Rabbi Freehoff to Pittsburgh and to Ritter Scholem would certainly be considered one of the highlights of his serving on the
board. Would think so. And Father, during earlier years, had, as I think I told you, been a member of the committee that had invited Dr. Levy to come to Pittsburgh in 1900, to come here in 1901. And Father had also been largely responsible for the selection of Dr. Goldenson, whom he had met on a trip to the Hebrew Union College, and to whom he had taken an immediate liking, and the congregation, I am sure, approved his choice.
I wonder if you happen to know, is this the way that many of the large Jewish congregations chose their rabbis? Was it usually that either the president or a board member of a large Reform congregation would have a chance to meet a rabbi that they were interested in bringing?
I presume that was more or less the method. Father has often told me that Dr. Levy was in no sense a personal choice of anyone, that he had been especially well known in Pittsburgh as a result of his rabbinate with Dr. Krauskopf at Knesset Israel in Philadelphia. So that when it was a question of finding someone to succeed Dr. Meyer, there was a pretty general feeling that Dr. Levy was the person to be invited. As to your question as to whether that was the general method for other congregations, I would imagine that it would be largely a question of some personal contact with someone. Under the present system, there is a rabbinic placement commission, a commission of the Central Conference of American Rabbis under an arrangement with the Union of American Hebrew Congregations. And the required method at the present time is to go through the placement commission to secure their recommendations of available rabbis.
But that certainly was not in the works in your father's day.
No, that the placement commission didn't come into existence until probably 1963, somewhere.
That late. Okay, going back a little further, On the first interview, we talked about the grandmother of your mother, and I wonder if you would tell us her name.
Henrietta Hanna, or Henrietta Lehrberger was her maiden name, and her married name was Mrs. Meyer Hanna.
Okay. Also earlier, we mentioned Minna Lippmann, and you were telling us that she came from Bavaria to Pittsburgh. Now, did she come directly to Pittsburgh, or was there someplace else that she went first for it?